Good afternoon. You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, our series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Festival and their Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, we bring you a deep dive into health out of the box, covering a wide range of topics from social justice and caregiving to emerging neuroscience and moonshots.
Good afternoon. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Thanks for joining us on Spotlight Health. Today, we talk about the need for a revolution in primary care with Dr. Andrew Morris Singer.
When you're not feeling well, a primary care doctor is probably your first stop. But most have a heavy load of patients whom they can only see for an average visit of 8 minutes.
This system isn't working for doctors or patients. Andrew looks at how strengthening relationships might save primary care.
We also talk with Jamila Headley, the managing director of the Health Global Access Project, or HealthGAP.
What if you had a serious illness and there were drugs out there that could extend your life? Great, right? But what if those drugs cost tens of thousands of dollars a year?
HealthGAP works to make sure that people living with HIV in targeted regions have access to affordable medicine. She says that, yes, gains have been made in treating people with HIV, but the cost of many drugs is a huge barrier to saving more lives.
That's today on Spotlight Health. Primary care doctors are burning out at a pretty alarming rate. Our first guest, Dr. Andrew Morris Singer, gave us a behind-the-scenes look at the enormous challenges they face.
He's the president and the founder of Primary Care Progress, or PCP. His organization provides leadership development and training to primary care doctors.
Part of this training is centered on how collaboration can help doctors treat patients more effectively.
Doctors are typically thought of as being pretty independent. We started off by asking him why a new focus on personal connections is so important in rethinking primary care.
I think the people that go into healthcare, not just the physicians here, but the nurses, the pharmacists, even the front desk receptionists at a practice, these people have a special orientation towards other people. They want to help, right? It's something that motivates them, right? They're deeply empathetic and they care about others. But the challenge is that, you know, the system's incredibly complex. There's a ton of stuff on our collective plate that we need to do to get the patient in front of us the care that they need. And the system is changing. It's not like it's static, right? The system is constantly changing right now. The things I'm required to do as a physician are literally shifting under my feet. And so when that happens, there's a tendency, once again, to focus on making the right diagnosis and identifying the perfect therapeutic, and getting all that documented in my new, electronic health record that's got all these new shiny buttons and applications and all that stuff. And what's the thing that sort of gets marginalized there? The relationship. So right now, when your average patient goes to see a physician in this country, that visit is usually about 8 minutes long, right? It's gotten incredibly complex. Over 50% of that time right now, the physician is staring at the computer, typing all of the information into the computer screen, not making eye contact with the patient. And that's incredibly dissatisfying to the patient as well as the physician.
What are some of the other challenges that you've seen facing primary care doctors?
Well, I think the bottom line is that the job in many ways as currently organized and paid for and regulated has become mission impossible. So they've done studies and they've shown all the stuff that's now required of physicians, right? All of the different acute care that they need to provide to patients, like, hey, I hurt my foot, or hey, I've got this bleeding going on, what's this about? All the chronic disease management that needs to occur, helping people manage their diabetes, their high blood pressure, and all the other work that we do, coordinating care, filling medications, building relationship. For your average primary care physician in this country who has an average panel of patients, all that care requires 21 hours of work a day, 7 days a week. That's impossible, right? That's one of the reasons that so many physicians are burning out in this country right now. One in two physicians is not only burnt out right now, but has indicated that they're planning on retiring from practice early. That's an existential problem for a nation, and it's a professional problem. for the physicians. I just want to sort of fill out for your listeners a little bit more of the picture of what's going on, because they don't necessarily get to see all the things that are going on behind the scenes. So one of the reasons that they get to spend so little time with their primary care doc, right, is that primary care has been poorly invested in. Despite 18% of our collective GDP going to healthcare in this country, only a measly 4% of that goes to primary care. Despite the fact that everybody needs primary care, and despite the fact that loads of studies have shown the value of primary care, that those areas of the country that have higher levels of primary care physicians end up having better overall quality of care, happier patients, and lower healthcare spending. Despite all of that, your average health system has invested nothing in primary care. And so to stay in business, right, to cover the overhead, to keep the lights on, your average primary care doc has to basically churn through all these visits. So all these visits get shortened. All these visits just end up being 8 minutes long. And there are so many things that we require patients to come into the office for that they don't actually need to be seen for, right? So if you come in and give blood and get your annual visit, right, I could give you all that information over email or over the phone, or I could text it to you, right? Or if you have a sore throat and just say, hey, you know, I need some basic medication for this. Can you fax it to my pharmacy? There is a pressure on physicians to bring patients in because we only get paid right now when we see the whites of patients' eyes. And unless we have enough of these visits during the day, we cannot stay in business. So just that one small piece of this puzzle has a humongous impact on the day-to-day professional reality of physicians and the experience and satisfaction of patients. And that's just one example of some of the things going on behind the scenes.
Let's talk about primary care progress, because I'm so interested in how your organization is addressing some of these problems that doctors are facing.
So if one were to accept the probability that it's going to be a while for healthcare reform to play out, and it's going to take a long time to really shift our system towards a model that works for patients and works for providers and physicians and also works for the people who are paying for care, then you sort of accept this notion that we need a lot of leadership in healthcare. We need more physicians being able to lead the transformation and lead the shift in care to a new place and lead the advocacy in partnership with patients to change the system and some of these constraints we've described. And so we, as an organization, committed to being that leadership space, to developing the next generation of leaders in healthcare, and particularly in primary care, to lead the transformation in the system so that it works better for patients, it works better for physicians, and it works better for the people paying for care. And so we have chapters all over the country where we do work with students, health profession students, teaching them these leadership practices, and we can talk about what that looks like in a sec. And then we also do work with existing providers, physicians, multidisciplinary care teams, which is just another way of saying a team that includes a doc and a social worker and a nurse. And we also work with the leaders of healthcare system.
What role have patients taken in your organization? What feedback are you getting? Are they guiding the process at all?
So the patient voice is absolutely critical to the work that we do. And I would say that we as an organization are on the same journey that all other organizations in healthcare are on. And that's the journey of really starting to build true partnerships and co-design with patients. You know, when I was trained, which was, you know, actually not that long ago, there was really no such thing as patient-centeredness and co-design. You know, I was taught that I'm the doctor and I have the answer, and patient comes in for the answer, and I sort of tell them what the answer is, and I encourage them to do the management plan, and they go off and do it, right? Well, the data showed that most patients actually didn't end up doing what we talked about. And they didn't end up doing it for a whole variety of reasons. But what we started learning as a profession was that this was a partnership. And this had to be a conversation, right? So now when I see a patient and they come in and they present the problem, I no longer tell them what to do, right? I have a conversation with them about what I think is going on and the options for handling it. And then we have a conversation where they tell me about their goals and their values and what's feasible and what's not feasible. And so we co-design the plan of action, right? And that might be for how they're going to lose weight. It might be for how they're going to stop smoking. It might be for how they're going to address the insomnia they're having. But it's a conversation where we're ensuring that the plan we come up with is consistent with their values, consistent with their preferences, and is something that they're actually going to do. And so more and more healthcare organizations are realizing they have to do this in the trenches. So they have to have this phenomenon taking place in the one-on-one interactions between patients and physicians. But they also need to engage patients in how we're designing our clinics and how we're designing our policies. And we're taking the same approach with how we design our programs, that the patient's voice is critically important for really setting, due north in terms of where we need to go.
I mean, that's quite a paradigm shift. And I'm wondering what your kind of training looks like to help make that happen. What do people get when they go to a PCP training session?
Well, the first thing they get when they come to Primary Care Progress is they get a vision of hope for the future. Because a lot of people in healthcare right now, Kristen, have a pretty dismal view of where we're going in terms of our healthcare system. Many of them really see no future for themselves in healthcare. And so that's something that we have to change. Secondly, we're very much focused on relational leadership. So really helping people understand, how do you build relationships with patients? How do you build relationships with colleagues in the context of teams? How do you really build relationships with systems and understand the ecosystem in which you operate? Who are the major stakeholders? And how to basically work with those people and their interests to move towards a common goal? So a lot of our training really focuses on skills oriented towards relationships. So first, relationship with the self, right? Getting a better understanding of oneself, one's values, what one brings to a situation, and how to manage one's emotions and one's strengths and how one communicates with others. And that enables one to be much more intentional about what they're bringing to the team space. And that's the second area of focus for us. How do we help people actually build partnerships and team up in an interdependent way so we're really relying on one another to achieve a common goal? And so those partnerships could be with patients. Those partnerships could be a multidisciplinary care team that has a social worker, a pharmacist, and a nurse, and a physician. Then we focus on how do you mentor and coach another person, help them with their own professional growth and development. And then finally, we teach people how to advocate. Right? How to partner with other people to stand up and change the system and ensure that it's consistent with the values of those who have stake in it.
Can I ask you, why is this so critical? Like, what is at stake here for patients and for doctors?
Well, I think what's at stake here is that the current system doesn't work for us. The current system doesn't work for patients. The current system doesn't work for providers and physicians. And the current system also doesn't work for those who are paying for care. And so we need to really shift how we approach change. We need to do it at the individual level, and we need to do it at the system level. And we believe that if we're going to truly change the American healthcare system, not only do we have to come up with the right plans and the right policies and the right programs, but we really need to get the relationships right with patients, between different members of the care team, and between health professionals and policymakers. And we're just ensuring that that this next generation has that full comprehensive set of approaches to change.
You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You just heard from Dr. Andrew Morris Singer. He will be speaking during Aspen Institute's Spotlight Health Conference this year.
Each week, we talk to leaders in research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health and medicine. Up next on Spotlight Health, Jamila Headley, Managing Director of Health Global Access Project, or HealthGAP.
HealthGAP sees HIV/AIDS as more than a medical problem. They say it's a political one.
HealthGAP works with governments to promote access to treatments for those living with HIV and AIDS across the globe. This means that they take on the pharmaceutical industry and international agencies when their practices make it hard for people to get the medicine they need.
We started by talking to Jamila about the crisis that led to the founding of HealthGAP.
When HealthGAP started in 1998, much like today, the majority of people living with HIV were living in the world's poorest countries, and almost none of them had access to life-saving medicines. HealthGAP really emerged in that context to dedicate itself to the goal of making sure that all people living with HIV, no matter where they lived, no matter who they were, no matter what their economic situation was, no matter who their government was, would have access, affordable access to life-saving medicines that they needed. Now, our analysis at that time and still now was that HIV and AIDS was not a biomedical problem, it was a political one. And I can say more by what I meant by that. We felt fundamentally that the AIDS crisis was a problem of power. That there were people, that there were institutions that had the power to change the reality that we were seeing on the ground. There were governments who were refusing to acknowledge that there was even a crisis or refusing to invest resources in the response. There were big pharmaceutical corporations who were charging exorbitant prices for medicines in a way that many felt was unjust. And so we felt like there were very clear seats of power who were holding back the response. And so our entire mission, organization, and focus has been on addressing HIV, not as a biomedical crisis or a crisis of sexual behavior or any of that, but as a political crisis.
What are the barriers to treatment in the countries in which you've worked?
So, I mean, there's a couple. First, the price of medicines continues to be a major barrier. When we first started in this response, the first AIDS drugs came out at around $20,000 a year. That was way too expensive for most people living with HIV and their governments around the world. We, through a series of interventions and as well through making the arguments about what should be a just price of medicines, through making sure that countries had access to use flexibilities that are built into kind of global trade rules to help protect public health, we helped bring the price of those drugs down to around $100 per year. But with every new HIV drug that comes out, we find ourselves fighting a very similar battle, right? And we've seen this, for example, most recently with a drug that's very much important for many people living with HIV, even though it's not an HIV drug in particular, around hepatitis C drugs, which came out on the market at around $80,000 a year. Again, life-saving curative medication that was completely out of reach for the people who needed it most. So with each new drug, we find ourselves fighting the barrier of the price that's set by pharmaceutical corporations and this need for excessive amounts of profit there. We also have major challenges in terms of funding for the response more generally, both in terms of sustaining donor funding for the response, which we see with the US government now in the new budget that has been leaked from the Trump administration is directly under threat in the United States, but is under threat in other donor countries as well, as well as in mobilizing investment from developing countries themselves in their own HIV response. So that continues to be a challenge and an area of work that many of us continue to work on. There's also a challenge in terms of what works. You know, we are increasingly seeing that a kind of clinic-based, hospital-based biomedical model for delivering care for people living with HIV is not the most effective way. Because this is a disease that's highly steeped in stigma and discrimination, and we can't just address it by having people come to a clinic. And increasingly, we're having to challenge ourselves in health systems to move outside of the clinic setting to embrace new models of care that are client-driven and that are patient-driven. And that has been a big challenge to get governments who are steeped in a medical system that they can control and doctors who are used to being in charge of their patients to embrace a model that we can see is effective and that is having good results that involves pushing care out into the community. So there are barriers at numerous points, and Health Gap is in a way involved in addressing each of these barriers in various ways.
You talked about moving outside of clinics and moving toward the people who actually need the treatment and the challenges there. What does that look like? What has Health Gap done to make that happen?
So in many countries, and Médecins Sans Frontières has been at the forefront of kind of experimenting with some of these models of care, but this is nothing mind-blowing that communities do. You know, one of the challenges we have is making sure that people continue to take their medicines and adhere to their medicines. We have incredible science that shows that if people are taking their medicines well, and we can keep the level of virus in their bodies down, that they are unable to transmit the virus to other people. That is tremendous news, because it means that the treatment that we're providing to people around the world for HIV also helps to act as a preventive barrier in terms of making sure that other people stay HIV negative. But that involves them really taking their medicines well and consistently. There are community ARV groups that have started up that both can dispense now medications to people in the others in the community, but also provide a support group to make sure that people are taking their medicines on time. One of the things that we've done to help expand models like that is in processes like I was describing that we were in with the US government last week, where they're talking about how to spend $500 million in South Africa or $600 million in Kenya to address the HIV response, is in pushing for them to allocate much more of that funding to those kinds of models of care that we know have a high degree of efficacy with people living with HIV.
I saw on your bio on the Spotlight Health, the Aspen New Voices webpage, just you have studied the effects of trade agreements on health policy. So can you tell me a little bit, what are some effects that you've seen with trade agreements on health policy, especially because trade agreements are once again in the news in the US?
So this directly has to do with the price of medicines that I was talking about before. And many trade agreements grant companies exclusive rights to intellectual property rights to technologies that they develop. But we've always argued that a drug, a life-saving drug for people living with HIV, should not be treated in the same way as a new toy, right? Or a new iPhone. And should not be commoditized in the same way for a couple reasons. One, there are many inputs that go into research and development for these drugs. And we know that actually a lot of public money goes into developing many of the drugs, life-saving drugs that we are concerned about. And that then drug companies take and develop and reap profits on. And so part of what we try to do in trade agreements is shore up some of the big wins that we've had at the level of the World Trade Organization to say that all countries should be able to be flexible about how they interpret intellectual property right rules so that they can make sure that they can protect their public health. And that specifically, there's a provision there for low and middle income countries. But that's been a provision that has been undermined by the proliferation of many different small trade agreements between countries and between regions that have often asked for what we call TRIPS plus recommendations, have asked for countries to go beyond what they've already agreed to at the World Trade Organization level. So, for example, we recently came out of a very kind of intense fight around the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, because there were several provisions in that agreement which would have called on countries to go beyond what is agreed at the WTO level, and would have restricted their ability to produce cheaper versions of drugs, generic versions of life-saving drugs, or to buy generic versions of life-saving drugs from other countries.
Are you hopeful about the future when you think about HIV and AIDS?
It's been quite a difficult period for us over the last few months. We've made tremendous gains. This is a movement that we know you can win. I mean, there are many other movements. It takes years to win, often in social movements, right? It takes years to change something that is really that feels very intractable. And with HIV, we've had a lot of gains, and we've seen major transformations, and we've seen a movement that's been smart and quick on its toes and able to really challenge power in a massive way. But we are so far from being done yet, you know? And we're in this phase where it feels like the world is no longer sees the issue as a crisis. But those of us who spend time in many of the countries that are hardest hit by this epidemic, know that this crisis is still raging on. And so it's really concerning to see cut budgets from the administration and to really feel that the world is moving on from seeing this epidemic as a crisis. The thing that I always go back to, and in the moments where I feel, it's these faces of people who felt powerless, but who now know that they are not powerless at all. And in fact, have learned to very strategically leverage the power that they do have, that give me hope that we will find a way through the new challenges that are emerging in our context. We've always known that this would be a long fight, that this wasn't going to be done quickly, and we're in it for the long haul.
That was HealthGap Managing Director Jamila Headley. HealthGap advocates for access to life-saving medications for those living with HIV and AIDS. Currently, their Washington operation is organizing a grassroots push to tell Congress not to cut funding for HIV/AIDS treatment across the globe. She's speaking at this year's Spotlight Health Conference at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Thanks for joining us on Spotlight Health this afternoon. You can hear this show again and stream past shows online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm host Allison Bechtesh, along with Kristen Kay, who produces this series.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when we talk to Ai-Zhen Pu, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations, as well as Stephen Keating, a patient advocate. You won't believe the extraordinary lengths he's gone to in order to be as involved as possible in the treatment of his own health issues.
You've been listening to Spotlight Health, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and their Spotlight Health Conference. Join us Tuesdays at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2017 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen to this series online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2017 conference runs from June 22nd through 25th and features four program tracks: the brain, moonshots, intersections, and caregiving. Spotlight Health is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.